However, the two powers which would make most use of the opportunities presented by the descent of the Mughal heartlands into anarchy were not Indian at all. In Pondicherry and Madras, two rival European trading companies, alerted to Mughal weakness and the now deeply divided and fragmented nature of authority in India, began to recruit their own private security forces and to train and give generous wages to locally recruited infantry troops. As the EIC writer William Bolt later noted, seeing a handful of Persians take Delhi with such ease spurred the Europeans' dreams of conquest and empire in India. Nadir Shah had shown the way. William Dalrymple, The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-4, The Nizam. The Nizams of Hyderabad. The story of the Nizam dynasty in Hyderabad begins during the reign of Shah Jahan. In 1650, a Central Asian noble named Abid Khan stopped in Mughal India on his way to Mecca for Hajj. He met Prince Aurangzeb, who at that time was the governor of Deccan. The two men clicked, and Prince Aurangzeb asked Abid Khan to join his service after completing the Hajj. Abid Khan agreed and returned to India in 1656. The War of Succession between Aurangzeb and his brothers began the very next year in 1657. And as we know, Aurangzeb was victorious and Abid Khan was rewarded for his loyalty. For the next half century, Abid Khan and his family remained in service to Emperor Aurangzeb. Abid Khan died in 1686 and his son, Ghaziuddin Firoz Jung, continued to work for Aurangzeb. We discussed Ghaziuddin Firoz Jung in the previous season. Muhammad Amin Khan, who was Ghaziuddin's first cousin, also benefited from this relationship. Muhammad Amin Khan served as Aurangzeb's Sadr al-Sudur, or head of religious endowments. Ghaziuddin's son, Asif Jah, continued the family tradition and also served under Aurangzeb. We know Asif Jah as either Chinglish Khan or his other title, Nizam al-Mulk. While Abid Khan and his sons were loyal to Aurangzeb, they were not so loyal to Aurangzeb's sons. There's some speculation that Aurangzeb deliberately isolated his sons from his top nobles. This prevented his sons from establishing strong relationships with these nobles. Hence, as Aurangzeb grew older, Ghaziuddin and Asif Jah, that is, Nizam al-Mulk, were uncertain about their future. What would happen to them after Aurangzeb died? With this uncertainty in mind, they began stockpiling weapons in preparation for that inevitable day. After Aurangzeb died, a fraternal war broke out amongst his sons, which Bahadur Shah won in 1707. However, Ghaziuddin and Nizam al-Mulk had remained neutral during the fighting. Bahadur Shah did not punish Nizam al-Mulk and his family for not supporting him during the war, but he didn't give them any significant positions or titles either. 5 years later, in 1712, Bahadur Shah died, leading to yet another fratricidal war. Once again, Nizam al-Mulk did not take sides, and once again, he did not benefit much when Jahandar Shah took the throne. When Farrukh Siyar overthrew Jahandar Shah in 1713, Nizam al-Mulk again stayed on the sidelines. However, by this time, the Sayyid brothers were pulling the strings in the imperial court. Farrukh Siyar appointed Nizam al-Mulk as governor of Deccan in 1713, then dismissed him in 1715. During this period, Nizam al-Mulk and his uncle, Muhammad Amin Khan, had a falling out. Nonetheless, they put their differences aside and worked together to defeat the Sayyids in 1720. And we discussed all this in the first episode of this season. After the Sayyid brothers' downfall, Muhammad Amin Khan stayed on as the Mughal Grand Vizier, while Nizam al-Mulk went back to ruling the Deccan. And as we know from earlier episodes, Muhammad Amin Khan died in 1722, and Nizam al-Mulk replaced him as Grand Vizier. In this new position, Nizam tried to save the weakening empire, but he was thwarted by Rangila's enablers. These were particularly his milk sister Koki B and Kamaruddin. Eventually, Nizam al-Mulk got fed up with the court politics and returned to the Deccan in 1724. Now let's discuss how Nizam al-Mulk established his rule in the Deccan after his self-imposed exile from Delhi. Even though the Sayyids were now gone, Nizam al-Mulk faced many problems in the Deccan. First of all, he had absolutely no confidence in the emperor, Muhammad Shah, quote-unquote, Rangila. Secondly, Mughal authority in the Deccan was constantly being challenged. The Marathas, Afghans, and Telugus were not going to just peacefully submit to Nizam al-Mulk. They posed a serious threat to Nizam al-Mulk's position in the Deccan. The Deccan, as we know, was known for its instability. Even though the region had fallen to the Mughals in 1680, there had been continuous fighting ever since then. A weak Mughal emperor only exacerbated this instability as Nizam al-Mulk could not count on the imperial military. Therefore, Nizam al-Mulk had to grow and strengthen his position in the Deccan on his own. There was also a language and cultural barrier. Nizam al-Mulk's family was from Central Asia, and he had grown up in the royal court. So the Persian language and culture were a part of his background. However, in southern India, things were different. The Tamil Nadu, Mysore, and Kerala languages dominated many parts of this area. Despite these disadvantages, the Nizam did have some things working in his favor. Just listen to this quote. During his second stint as governor of the Deccan, 1720 to 1722, the Nizam made an important decision. Unsure of his political future in the imperial capital, the Nizam began to build a base for himself in the Deccan. It is unlikely that the Nizam was working towards a declaration of independence, as suggested by some scholars. Rather, it seems that he hoped to use his control over the Deccan to leverage the position of wazir at the imperial court. Whatever his motives, the impact of the Nizam's actions are clear. He installed family members and imperial loyalists in many of the most important positions across the Deccan. At empire's end, the Nizam, Hyderabad, and 18th century India, Muniz D. Faruqi, Modern Asian Studies, Volume 3, January 2009. Now this quote shows that Nizam al-Mulk had a strong and loyal military corps who had served him for decades. Nizam had cultivated his officers and political supporters over a long period, and even though the imperial government was weak, there were still many competent bureaucrats throughout India. Seeing they could no longer rely on the emperor for work or employment, so to speak, many of them were willing to serve under Nizam. And even though he was not from the Deccan, Nizam al-Mulk made sure to learn as much as possible about the local politics and cultures. He removed officials he did not trust and replaced them with family members and people he did trust. He gave these trusted officials large plots of land as a source of revenue to ensure their loyalty, and he knew which groups could be bribed and which groups had to be motivated with violence. All of this ensured the Nizam had full control over the Deccan's governmental structure. Now, of course, he still had to deal with the Marathas. Every Mughal emperor and Deccan governor since Akbar the Great had to deal with the Marathas. Now, there were two major rival Maratha factions in the Deccan at this time. Each faction was led by a different grandson of Shivaji, the first Chhatrapati or Maratha king. We discussed the origins of this rivalry back in Season 9. Initially, both Maratha factions had supported Nizam al-Mulk, but eventually they united against him. By 1728, the Nizam was forced to capitulate to many of the Maratha demands. This hurt his reputation, but it also allowed him to continue building his state. Nizam al-Mulk died in May 1748, shortly after Emperor Muhammad Shah, quote-unquote, Rangila, died. The First Carnatic War. Now let's do a brief history of the French East India Company. The French East India Company was founded in 1664 during the reign of King Louis XIV, and its primary purpose was to compete with the British and Dutch in India and Southeast Asia. However, the French company faced many early challenges. By the late 1600s, France had established several trading posts in Surat. These included Pondicherry in 1674, Chandernagore in 1686, Mahé, Yanam, and Karaikal. Pondicherry became the administrative center and the most important French colony in India. Pondicherry thrived as a strategic and commercial hub for textiles and spices. However, the French East India Company began to decline after the Seven Years' War, which lasted from 1756 to 1763. This led to the Treaty of Paris, which further reduced French power in India. After continuous financial and political struggles, the French East India Company was dissolved in 1769. There was a brief attempt at a revival in 1785, but that also failed. The company was finally abolished in 1794, after the French Revolution. In its first incarnation, the Compagnie lost substantial amounts of money, and in 1719, it had to be refounded by the brilliant Lowland Scots financier John Lord de Lauriston, who had fled from London to France after a duel and rose to become an advisor to the Regent Orléans. Lord combined two small insolvent French Indies companies and raised enough money to make it a going concern. But the Compagnie des Indes remained permanently underfunded. Unlike the EIC, which was owned by its shareholders, from the beginning, the French Compagnie was partially a royal concern run by aristocrats who, like their king, tended to be more interested in politics than trade. William Dalrymple, The Anarchy. The Pragmatic Solution. The British and French were initially just merchants, but were now amassing power and wealth in India. They had also seen how easily Nadir Shah had destroyed Delhi, and they were convinced they could take the city if they really wanted to. However, the British and the French were also staunch rivals. Ever since the late 1600s, they had been fighting over territory and power in Europe and the Americas. In India, these conflicts played out as the Carnatic Wars. It all began with the War of the Austrian Succession in 1744. Back in 1713, Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI passed what became known as the Pragmatic Sanction. Charles VI was from the Austrian branch of the Habsburg dynasty. This sanction declared that if he died without any sons, all his lands would pass to his daughter, Maria Theresa. Well, Emperor Charles VI died in October 1740, and sure enough, he did not leave behind any sons. So with his death, Maria Theresa became Empress of the Holy Roman Empire. However, the King of Prussia, Frederick II, later to be known as Frederick the Great, saw this as an opportunity. He ordered an invasion of Silesia, one of the wealthiest regions in the otherwise impoverished Holy Roman Empire. The conflict spreads to India. The Coromandel Coast is on the eastern seaboard of India, known as Carnatic. The Nawab of Karnatak ruled the region for the Mughals. This region is famous for its spices, and it was the spice trade that attracted Europeans to this region in the first place. The British had two trading posts on the Coromandel Coast, Fort St. David and Fort St. George. The town of Madras, which is now modern-day Chennai, grew from Fort St. George. The French trading post, Pondicherry, was also on the Coromandel coast. By 1744, the War of Austrian Succession had dragged the British and French into the conflict. The British had a long-standing alliance with Austria because they wanted the Habsburgs to act as a barrier against French expansion. Therefore, when Prussia invaded Austrian Silesia and triggered the war, Britain chose to ally with Austria. The British did not want France to take advantage of Austria's weakness and dominate the Low Countries. The Low Countries was the area that is now known as Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. France, on the other hand, quite obviously wanted to weaken Austria, which was its traditional rival. Hence, France supported Prussia, Bavaria, and Spain, all of whom opposed the Austrian succession. France was also hoping to expand its influence and territory at Austria's expense. The fighting between Britain and France in Europe led to fighting between Britain and France in India. In 1745, the British launched a naval attack on a French fleet off the coast of India. The French Governor General in India, Joseph François Duplay, requested additional forces, and a second French fleet arrived in 1746. In July of that year, the French fought an indecisive battle against the British fleet off Nagapattinam, about 67 miles down the coast from Pondicherry. The two fleets met yet again in August 1746, but realizing they were outgunned, the British fleet retreated to Bengal. In September 1746, the French fleet attacked the British port at Madras. After several days of bombardment, the British surrendered and the French conquered the city. Some British officials, including a young clerk named Robert Clive, managed to escape. Robert Clive would later play a significant role in expanding British rule in India. The Nawab of Karnataka at this time was Anwaruddin Muhammad Khan. Before the attack, Joseph François Duplay, the Governor General for France and India, had offered to give Madras to Anwaruddin if he remained neutral. However, after the French conquered Madras from the British, Duplay reneged on this promise. Anwaruddin Khan attacked the French with an army of 10,000 soldiers, but the French defeated him at the Battle of Adar in October 1746. Duplay decided to launch an assault on Fort St. David in June 1748. This became known as the Siege of Cuddalore. Anwaruddin sent his son, Muhammad Ali, to assist the British. Together, the British and the Nawab's forces successfully repulsed the French, who had to retreat. Later that year, the British besieged the French at Pondicherry. The siege was lifted in October 1748 to the monsoons, and the war finally ended with the Peace of Aix-la-Chapelle in December 1748. Under this agreement, the French returned Madras to the British, and the British returned the fortress of Louisbourg in Nova Scotia, Canada, to the French. Inshallah, in the next episode, we'll discuss the Rohillas and the Second Carnatic War. For those of you with young kids, I know how tough it can be to teach them Islamic history. Kids just want to play, right? But alhamdulillah, some amazing Muslim creatives have made it easier. They've developed a fun game called Time Hoppers, where kids travel through the golden age of Islam, learning about Muslim scientists and scholars. They even worked with historians to make sure it's accurate. You can download it for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And be sure to check out MuslimKids.tv for more fun and educational Islamic content, including a high-quality 3D animated version of Time Hoppers coming soon, inshallah. Use coupon code IslamicHistoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, for 20% off an annual subscription to MuslimKids TV. Spread the word. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 through 105 AH. This is episode 3-4, Iraq and Khorasan. In the first part of this episode, we're going to discuss the events of the year 98 AH. This year roughly corresponds with 717 of the Common Era. We'll be discussing the Umayyad conquest of Jurjan and Tabaristan. Now, both of these regions are located in modern-day Iran. Jurjan is actually the modern Iranian city of Gorgan. It's located near the southeastern part of the Caspian Sea, and Tabaristan is located further to the west towards the central part of the Caspian Sea, just northwest of the city of Tehran. Tabaristan is also the birthplace of Abu Ja'far At-Tabari, the author of Tariq At-Tabari, where I'm actually getting much of this information from. So let's discuss the conquest of Jurjan by the Umayyads. Jurjan was initially conquered by Sa'id ibn al-As during the reign of Uthman ibn Affan radiallahu anhu. Sa'id ibn al-As was a member of the Umayyad clan, and there's no relation between him and the great companion Amr ibn al-As. We briefly mentioned Sa'id ibn al-As in the Islamic History Podcast Season 3. In that episode, we mentioned how Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan, who was the Umayyad caliph at the time, briefly considered making Sa'id ibn al-As governor of Kufa. Instead, however, he went on to appoint Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad instead. Now, after the conquest of Jurjan by Sa'id ibn al-As, the people of Jurjan actually agreed to pay tribute. But over the years between Muawiyah and now Caliph Sulayman, the people of Jurjan, their payments became more infrequent, and eventually they stopped paying completely and refused to start back up again. In fact, the people of Jurjan, or the Jurjani army, I should say, they attacked any Arabs they saw coming through their area of control. So this was used by Yazid ibn Muhallab, who was the current governor of Khorasan, which we discussed in the previous episode. Yazid ibn Muhallab used this as justification for attacking Jurjan. Now, there are several conflicting accounts about what actually happened in Tariq At-Tabari, and it's kind of confusing to go through all of them. Instead, I'll just summarize it by eventually Yazid ibn Muhallab and the Umayyad forces were able to compel the people of Jurjan to agree to similar terms as they had initially agreed with Sa'id ibn al-As all those years earlier. So now let's discuss Tabaristan. After he had subdued Jurjan, Yazid ibn Muhallab led his forces west towards Tabaristan. Then he began besieging and raiding the area around Tabaristan. The Ispabad, or the military chief or the military commander of Tabaristan, asked for peace with Yazid ibn Muhallab, and he even offered to pay more than the customary amount in tribute. However, for whatever reason, Yazid ibn Muhallab, he wanted to conquer the region by force, and he refused all offers of a peaceful settlement. So the siege continued, and eventually the Ispabad, that's the military commander of Tabaristan, the Ispabad called on his Persian allies to come help him. Among these Persian allies who answered the call were the recently defeated Jurjanis, the people of Jurjan. So now the Umayyads had to fight not just the people of Tabaristan in front of them, but also the second force of enemies coming from behind. A contingent of Umayyad fighters broke off from the main body and started fighting these allies who had come to help the Tabaristanis. They chased these Persian allies into the mountains, but this may have been a trap because as soon as the Arabs, the Umayyad forces, entered the mountain passes, the Persians were able to quickly turn the tables against them. The Persians began ambushing the Muslims as they made their way through the mountain pass. They began raining down arrows on them and throwing rocks on them. Eventually, the Muslim contingent that had broken off from the main army, it was completely routed, and they ran back out the mountain pass to rejoin with Yazid ibn Muhallab and the main body of the Umayyad forces.